welcome back to the Brexit podcast. I am your host, Tim Hemming, and today we are going to look at what Jeremy Corbyn really thinks of Britain's decision to leave the European Union. While the Labour leader's political stock's written to such an extent he could conceivably become the next Prime Minister, his view on Brexit still confuses much of the electorate. I'm joined by Paul Goldsmith, who's author of the recently published How to Lose a Referendum, the definitive story on why the UK voted for Brexit. And he's going to explain why the Labour Party's long since been divided over the issue of Europe, how much of the European legislation is at odds with true Corbynism, and how the man at the helm can really influence thousands of people to chant his name at festivals while being completely ambivalent to the Remainers' cause. Paul also covers the issue in one of his blog posts, which we will put a link to in the show notes. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback. You can find Brexit Podcast at Twitter and Facebook. But until then, enjoy the interview with Paul.
Hi, Tim.
Thanks for joining us this morning, Paul. We want to dedicate this episode to actually Jeremy Corbyn, who he is and what he's about. So in relation to Brexit, you're a man who's studied this now at length, wrote a book on it. What do you think Jeremy Corbyn's view actually is?
Funnily enough, lots of people think they know what his view is, so some people just say he's a Brexiter. They point at things like him voting against the EU in the 1975 referendum, voting against the Single Market Act in 1987, Maastricht in 1992. The truth is, he's actually quite indifferent to Europe. He barely ever spoke in any of the debates that went on, and yes, whilst he did vote no, it was for a slightly different reason than most people do. It wasn't necessarily about sovereignty. It certainly wasn't about immigration. It was actually because, and this happened, he talked about this during his leadership debates in 2015. He worries about it being a sort of capitalist cartel, a sort of rich man's club. And he's aware that a lot of the things that he would like to be able to do, so state aid to struggling industries, state ownership of things, public procurement and things like that, are made impossible by membership of the European Union. The European Union also has a stability and growth pact. You've got 3% of GDP for deficits, 60% for national debts. And that means effectively it legalizes austerity and things like that and encourages austerity. I think the thing for Jeremy Corbyn is that when we studied it and we looked at what was his real view, we came up with indifference because if you look at the EU referendum campaign, when he said, I think it's 7 out of 10, it was on the last leg, he was one of the few people who was telling the truth. He sees the social protections, the economic protections, but the EU is just not as important to him as other things.
I understand. Do you think really he's more of a pro-Brexiter than he lets on? And it was such a political hot potato that it was better just to park it and avoid it and concentrate on domestic issues, particularly in regard to the last general election?
Well, certainly. So the last general election is a very interesting case in point. The Labour Party, if you actually ask a lot of Labour people to vote between being in Europe and not, the majority will vote to be in Europe. But it doesn't mean that that matters more than austerity, redistribution, nationalisation and things like that. Over 90% would say, I want to end fox hunting. But if Jeremy Corbyn turned up one day and said, right, I'm going to legalise fox hunting again, but I'm going to end austerity, I'm going to nationalise the energy companies, I'm going to charge 55% to the richest people, they'd be, oh, okay. My point being, on the doorstep during the general election, actually, Labour voters tended to care more about those things. And if the EU really mattered, then the Lib Dems would be in government again, because that was the non-Brexit party. But let's go back to the referendum campaign. People think he was a Brexiter. He was in a difficult position because he was the leader of the Labour Party, and he had to lead this campaign, and Jeremy Corbyn is an authentic politician, really, in that he does what he believes in. And the problem is that he can't pretend he believes in something that he doesn't, which is why saying he thinks it's 7 out of 10 is probably very true. We don't know how he voted. Obviously, he's going to say he voted Remain. But what I do think that he is quietly happy about, along with John McDonnell, is, well, we're going to leave the European Union, but I don't have to do it. All the mess is going to be made and tried to be sorted out by the Tories, and then theoretically he could end up in government with complete freedom to implement radical policies that he could not legally implement if we were in the European Union. And that's the thing he knows. And that's why it's a complicated situation when people are telling him 80% of Labour members want to stay in the EU or stay in the single market, you've got to follow them. He knows that the single market does restrict him. And so I think at the moment he is walking a very fine line, and my view is that he's actually walking it quite well.
So if his wish comes true and he becomes Prime Minister sooner rather than later, and in the way politics has gone over the last couple of years, we perhaps can't rule anything out. But if during the repeal bill, and obviously with such a narrow, such a sort of fragile government in place at the moment, there's a possibility that that a general election could be called sooner rather than later. And then Corbyn comes into that post. What then happens if that is before Brexit?
If it's before Brexit, as in before the end of the Article 50 process?
Yeah, before, June or March 2019.
He's indicated he's going to respect the result of the referendum. The amusing thing is that people think the general election result was a protest against Brexit. But Labour's manifesto, whilst not being massively clear, at least said, we are leaving the European Union. It did try and say that we will consider staying in the single market and customs union, but then it said we would try and control immigration. And the two are basically incompatible. So if he happens to get in before the end of the Article 50 process, I think he will probably follow it through. However, what he and John McDonnell and Diane Abbott have been saying recently is that everything's on the table. And that's because they can, because they're in opposition. I think if I was Jeremy Corbyn, although they are on an election footing right now, I'd quite like Theresa May to do that hard work and get us out of the European Union. And then what's possible then is to make sure that he takes advantage of that opportunity, because I think it's a really, really crushing responsibility to deliver this, that I'm not sure Jeremy Corbyn wants that much. But if he does, then I suppose what he would do is he would try and make sure that when we leave the European Union, we do so on terms that aren't damaging to the people he cares about most.
Mm. And who are those people?
Well, for instance, he does believe that it's important that the European Union provides jobs. So if the unions do support him quite a lot, and they are very, very aware that leaving the European Union in certain cases, and producer interests are very loud at the moment. The thing to understand about trade and free trade and things like that is that costs are very concentrated on few people, but the benefits are spread across the population. And so the unions will be concerned about transition period and things like that. The impact of a customs union could make an enormous difference. I'm not sure he's that as bothered about that, but an interesting thing is also with immigration. He was slightly misquoted he went on the Andrew Marr show on July the 22nd, I think it was, and he talked about immigration and cheap labor coming over here and firms exploiting them and things like that. And to be honest, that's true in that firms can offer very low pay and low working conditions because they've got an endless supply of workers. And actually what he would want to try and do is make sure we had an immigration regime. It doesn't necessarily lower immigration, but where it's not possible to undercut undercut UK workers and have this race to the bottom that he constantly talks about in terms of pay and working conditions and things like that. The Labour Party, as you will know, Tim, is a progressive alliance in itself. You've got sort of middle class metropolitans, and you've got the urban working class. Now, the thing is, the urban working class are less loud. So when people start talking about, oh, the Labour Party wants this, the Labour Party wants that, they're doing online polls that are probably mainly filled in by the metropolitan middle class, and who then present the views of those polls as that's the view of the Labour Party. The thing is, as they found out possibly to their cost during the referendum campaign, given the vote, the working class cannot necessarily be trusted to vote the same way. And you've got, this is the issue really, is that saying Labour has a view on Europe, it really doesn't, and it never really has. It's been Eurosceptic, then it's been Europhile, sort of depends on who the leader is. There are things that they know are good, so the bottom, a sort of bottom line for social protection and environmental protections is good. But one of the things is that the assumption that leaving the European Union would get rid of that bottom line assumes that the British population would vote for that.
Yeah, this sort of dive back into history is something that you make a good point of in your book, and I've read a recent article from you that outlines this as well, and this fact that Labour has always been split on this issue right back from 1950.
Yeah, so 1950 we refused to join negotiations for the European Coal and Steel Community, and in historical context that's quite understandable because we were trying to implement a New Jerusalem welfare state, NHS, and the European Coal and Steel Community would have had the authority to tell us to shut down coal mines and things like that, which is why Herbert Morrison, the Deputy Prime Minister, said it's no good, it'll never work, the Durham miners will never wear it. And then when it came into the 60s, Hugh Gaitskell, who was the Labour leader at the time, railed against our attempt to join the European Union first because he talked about the fact that we were going to abandon the Commonwealth. And what Labour tended to settle into then, because the Tories were the people in charge of the first application and the final successful one, is we don't want to join on Tory terms. By the 1970s, it was when Labour expected to be leading these negotiations to join and then lost an election. Harold Wilson's Labour Party was very, very split. They had votes against the Tory policy of joining the European Community, but they actually had a vote at conference in about 1972 to leave the European Community without a referendum if they came into power. And Harold Wilson, the Prime Minister at the time, threatened to resign if that went through. And that's how we ended up with Tony Benn's idea of a referendum, which went into their manifesto, and then they ended up in 1975 supporting the referendum, and it was won. But in 1983, remember, the manifesto that they had, which is commonly known as the longest suicide note in history, said that they would pull out of the European Community without a referendum, and that's because the far left of the party have always been heavily Eurosceptic. But the problem with that was that the British population were, well, Margaret Thatcher was popular, but also I think the British population felt that was probably a step too far. Then Labour made this journey towards Europhilia, partly accelerated by Jacques Delors in 1988, speaking to the trade union conference just after Margaret Thatcher had won three elections, and said, look, you can't get environmental and social protections at home in the UK, but the EU, which is a supranational authority, a higher legal authority, we can provide that for you. And he was given a standing ovation. And then in the 90s, Blair came in, the most Europhile prime minister since Edward Heath, been a far better communicator, and the integration process was accelerated. We had the Eastern European countries joining. We, of course, allowed all the immigrants in from Eastern Europe without transition controls, never really explaining it to the population, the benefits. And the splits were hidden at that time, partly because you were not allowed to complain about immigration because you were called a racist. And then it started to creep back in, and particularly when Jeremy Corbyn became leader, you've now got Labour Party members are actually split on this issue. I know they say 80% would stay in the single market. It's not as simple as that, because it's just not as important as other priorities. And for Labour to stay in the single market now, they probably have to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, and good luck with that.
You mentioned there about Tony Blair. Mm. You see, of course, Tony Blair signing Amsterdam and the Nice Treaties. And it feels a world away to call them both Labour. Obviously, they are both leaving the Labour Party, and yet the parties seem their ideas of what Labour should be almost feel like it should be two completely different parties.
Well, this is what is The Labour Party is a coalition, and the reason I called it a progressive alliance is because during the 2017 election, the Lib Dems and the Greens and some of the SNP were talking for a progressive alliance with the Labour Party to try and combine to win seats. And Kezia Dugdale, who's the Scottish Labour leader, said, we already are a progressive alliance. There are a huge spectrum of views. And Tony Blair, essentially, the funny thing about Corbynistas is that they call the Tony Blair years the wilderness years. And they call them the wilderness years because when Labour was out of power in the 80s, those were called the wilderness years. But the reason they call it the wilderness years, even though Labour were in power, is that they don't believe Tony Blair was a proper Labour politician. They nicknamed him Tory Blair and things like that. But the truth is that there are people, Blairites in that party, and there are Marxists in that party. So there are people from the whole spectrum, and that has to happen because of our election system, which rewards big parties that are sort of catch-all. The Conservative Party is also quite wide as well. And managing that is difficult. Corbyn did something pretty amazing during the 2017 election. People thought what he had done was a 0% strategy, in that he'd upset Remainers by talking about immigration leaving the single market. He'd upset Leavers by saying that we don't want to leave on Tory terms and voting against things. In fact, what had happened was that he pleased both of them, because he talked tough on immigration, so the Leavers liked that, and talked tough on the single market. But he'd also sort of said, well, we need to have all options on the table and things like that, and immigrants are good for the country. And so Remainers felt able. Everybody felt able to vote for him. And it was quite clever, really.
Well, most people did. I mean, I guess he still did lose that election.
He lost the election. 40% of the vote, 11, 12 million voters. He did lose the election, but he did a lot better than people thought. People thought what would happen is that there'd be a massive vote for the Lib Dems, because the Lib Dems were the exit from Brexit party, and that didn't quite happen. Now, the reason it didn't happen is because actually what Jeremy Corbyn was offering, for better or worse, was a program that offered lots of things to lots of people. A cynic might say he was bribing everybody with other people's money, but when you are ending tuition fees, when you're also saying we're going to keep the triple lock, we're going to keep the winter fuel allowance, we're going to even had the idea of VAT on private school fees in order to pay for free school meals for primary schools. And by the way, that would be illegal under EU rules, because you can't put VAT, according to EU rules, on socially useful products and services, such as, for instance, education. So that's a good pro-Brexit policy for you. And he did a lot better than people thought he would. People were predicting 140 seats. People were predicting a 25% share. We went back to a two-party system because, ultimately, people were saying, well, okay, we might leave the European Union, but I'm not giving Theresa May and the Conservatives a blank check. And that's why we're in this interesting position. And you're saying things like, well, there could be another election soon.
Yeah, and so when you have something like the Glastonbury Festival and so many people stand in a field and sing Jeremy Corbyn's name, why are they doing that? Because there must be a lot of his policies that they disagree with.
It's a very interesting phenomenon that he went to the Glastonbury Festival and told people who were paying £234 just to get in that they should boo the establishment. I think they like his brand of politics, which in some cases is telling them what they want to hear. He appeals to people who like to virtue signal a lot and say, well, I'm happy to pay a lot more taxes in order to fund public services, even though they're probably not the ones who are going to be paying those taxes. He sort of doesn't make anybody make difficult decisions, because he's saying a lot of this will be funded by debt, or it will be funded by taxes on people that aren't you. Although, funnily enough, some people criticize him for driving a wedge between generations, because most of the people at Glastonbury singing his name, their parents are the people who are going to have the higher taxes to pay. It's just they see him as a different type of politician to the sort of Oxford Union Debating Society that runs the Conservative Party. And he is. I mean, people who've met him, and I've met him, he's a thoroughly decent, nice person. You don't have to agree with his opinions all the time. But I think people are looking for something different at the moment. And you could argue he's populist or tells people what they want to hear. But also, he has kept some reasonably unpopular opinions as well on IRA and things like that, and terrorism, let's say, because that's what he believes in. And I think that people are looking for something different than what they've had, which are career, well, ironically, he's a career politician, but career politicians who seem to think they're sort of born to lead. He was a reluctant leader, but he seems now to be making the most of it.
You did mention there briefly the situation in Ireland. We had Conor Devine on the show recently, who's from Belfast. Mm. He's a businessman in Belfast, and he talked about how the dire economic situation in Northern Ireland could even lead to calls for reunification, just on the fact that people need to put food on their children's tables. Mm. Now, if Corbyn was in charge, if Corbyn was the Prime Minister, how would that leave the relationship with Ireland and the border issue? What do you think his view would be?
So, the thing about Ireland is that I think even before the election, even before the DUP became part of a confidence and supply agreement, they were starting to make their way towards a reunification referendum. And the reason I think that is because of the election, the Northern Ireland Assembly election back in March, when the Nationalists actually got a majority in the Northern Ireland Assembly for the first time in terms of seats. So these were the Republican side. There is a movement. What if you're in a Northern Irish population, you saw the entire Brexit debate go by without a mention of Northern Ireland. Nobody really thought about this border. That border is incredibly important, and other decisions are sort of made without thinking about them. So when Theresa May called the election, she doesn't mention Northern Ireland. She might mention Scotland, but she doesn't mention Northern Ireland. And there is a general movement towards thinking about maybe we might be better off if we reunify. And there are going to be a lot of people who don't want that. And if you have a referendum there, you're going to get a lot of passionate arguments against it. I think if Corbyn comes in, one of the issues that he will think about probably, because, and it would be understandable, is, well, everyone knows I support the Republican cause. I should probably be careful here because people will assume that I'm not a sort of honest broker in the middle of it. But I think that Northern Ireland and the people of Northern Ireland are beginning to think about maybe it might be better together than being this appendage on Britain. And this £1 billion that's gone to Northern Ireland because of the confidence and supply agreement, I think it's only a sticking plaster for their problems. They are a long way behind Britain in terms of infrastructure. And a £1 billion sticking plaster is perhaps not enough. And I think if we leave the EU, then it will become even more of a temptation, let's say, to look at that as an answer. But I think Ireland has a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Conor made the point that they have an annual £10 billion from in EU peace money at the moment, and that's going to dry up. So that one puts that £1 billion in perspective.
Mm.
So, moving forward, how do you see things panning out from here, and what role will Jeremy Corbyn have to play? I mean, in some ways, he's still not particularly popular with Labour MPs.
Yes, although speaking to some Labour MPs, they are aware that they probably owe their seats to him. And certainly, I'm in the constituency of Ealing and Acton Central, and the MP here had a 200 majority and came up against a Brexiter. And we have in Ealing and Acton 72% of people voted for Remain. And Rupert Huck is the MP here, and she's suddenly 13,000 is her majority. And so at the moment, he has a little bit of leeway. Not all the MPs agree with him, but then not all the MPs agreed with Tony Blair as well. And how he manages that is interesting. He's already sacked some shadow cabinet ministers for voting for the Labour amendment. And it was to do with the single market and the customs union. So he's starting to impose some discipline. But Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell have never been massive believers of the parliamentary route to socialism anyway. And so they are looking to work around the MPs and use the membership. The reselection and deselection are still on the table as well. Although they are quite old, John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, this has won him some extra time to find some other people to carry it on. I think it's important to understand Corbynism is slightly different to Corbyn. I know that sounds odd. And so I'm not sure he's that bothered about the MPs at the moment. The MPs are not going to challenge him. Some of them are saying stuff about, oh, if he doesn't do this, doesn't keep us in the single market, this will happen. But as I've said, if they want him to do it, they'll have to remove him, and that's just not going to happen at the moment. Mm. So whether or not MPs and Jeremy Corbyn are getting along is not necessarily the issue, and I don't think it's something that he's that bothered about, because he spotted, in the end, it wasn't a lot of MPs, I had leaflets through my door that didn't mention Jeremy Corbyn once. So a lot of MPs don't mention him, but the Momentum's election campaigning was outstanding. And the point of Corbynism is about people getting involved, people campaigning, people going door to door. The use of social media was outstanding as well. It's got nothing to do with the MPs. I think that this story's still got a long way to go.
I guess we'll, you know, if we're going to say he's not really a narcissist, then will it have to change from Corbynism, or do you think that term is now stuck? Do you think there's a successor lined up as well?
I don't think there's necessarily any positioning going on, but funnily enough, the longer he stays in, the more time they have to get ready and get some useful experience. You're seeing some profiles of people such as Angela Rayner recently going in the press and things like that. I think it's going to be very important that a successor that's trusted is put in place. This idea that it can be a Tukaramuna or someone from the other side of the party, I don't think that's going to work. And it's also useful that when Corbyn became leader, he had someone of the quality of Keir Starmer in the party, who's the shadow Brexit minister, because Keir Starmer has his amazing legal mind, which he's applying to this process, which actually means that Corbyn doesn't have to spend much time on it. So there are some possible successors, but it is a phenomenon, and it's a phenomenon that has taken lots of people by surprise, but it's now got considerable legs.
Finally, what are you up to yourself?
Well, having produced How to Lose a Referendum, we're now in the position where the Brexit process is going to be at the forefront of the news for a long time. We produced the book so that we could have people informed about the history and the campaign during the debate. I think history is particularly important. So whenever some Brexit ministers tend to say, oh, we can go back to a free trade deal, well, we've never had a free trade deal with the European Union. We have considered other books on elections or on Labour Party and Conservative Party. But at the moment, I think for the next 2 years or so, we will be doing work around the referendum and Brexit. The other thing that I do is I have a blog at pjgoldsmith.com, which is nicknamed Gold Blog. And I write about Brexit and certain other political ideas every 3 days or so. It's a blog that tries to explain what's going on. It's politically neutral, though if I have a strong opinion on something, then I'll probably talk about it. At the moment, what I'm writing about is explaining the debates over Euratom or talking about trade and things like that. And then when the Labour Party started telling Jeremy Corbyn, you're leader of the Labour Party, you have to stay in Europe, I thought I would write something about, well, Corbynism is impossible within the single market. And of course, I have my day job, which I love, which is teaching economics and politics.
Okay, Paul, thank you ever so much. We will add links to Goldblog and also on how to get the book into the show notes. And thank you again for joining us on the Brexit podcast.
Thank you, Tim. It's always lovely to see you.
That's all we've got time for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed the chat with Paul Goldsmith, and don't forget to have a look, have a search online and pick up a copy of the book. I think it'll be a fascinating read. You can get in touch with us through Facebook, Brexit Podcast, at Twitter, at Brexit Podcast, or just drop us a note through the website and drop us some feedback on the shows. That would be terrific. The Brexit Podcast is a Tim Hemming, Jen Hahn and Warren Pohl production. The theme music's by Kevin MacLeod, and we look forward to welcoming you back soon.